David, you told me that you feel lucky to be alive. And I got to say, just from your Facebook post, it certainly looks to me like you really appreciate that.
I do. Every day. I try to live every day. It sounds cliche, but I do.
It's obvious. And I want to say one thing about your book that really jumped out at me. Years ago, I used to attend an AA meeting in Silver Lake every single morning. And there was this delightful man. I don't know if I ever knew his name. He always came in early. He wore flamboyant clothing. And he had this incredible hat that had huge flowers that he picked from his garden every morning.
Nice.
And he just looked great. Well, he reminds me of a 1990s version of a certain character in your novel. And who do you think that would be?
Could that be Walter?
I think that's the case. So we're going to talk about Walter and as well a little bit about why David appreciates life so much right after this.
It's time to put on your sleuthing cap, feel nail-biting dread, and face heart-racing fear. This is Queer Writers of Crime, where you'll get book recommendations and hear interviews with LGBTQ authors of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. Here's your host, Brad Shreve.
So if you haven't figured it out, this is Brad, and you're listening to Queer Writers of Crime. My guest today is David S. Peterson, and his most recent novel is Murder on Monte Vista. And we were talking recently about Walter Waverly Wingate, which is a character in his recent novel that I adore. And there's a lot of people in this book that I adore. First of all, David, I want to say, people tell me I love dialogue. And I got to tell you, I do love dialogue.
So do I.
I write it, and then I go in and fill stuff in later because I just get totally caught up in the conversation.
That's what I do too.
Yes, I could tell that when I was reading it. And it's great because it's not always easy for people to do, but I felt like I was right in the middle of the conversation and I didn't need all the fork hitting the floor over there or the pink wallpaper on the wall. You know what I mean. You describe where we are, and so you do get a feel, but really with your book, it's all about the conversation. And that's great because you have a lot of characters and they're all very interesting, and it's a good way to learn who they are.
Cool.
So let's jump right in the story. And I'm going to say I want to do this because the story takes place in Phoenix, which is one of my favorite places in the world. I am sure I've said it at least 10,000 times on this podcast that when I lived there, I thought I would live there the rest of my life. Unfortunately, the company I worked for, they gave me an offer I couldn't resist, and I wish I did. Because I wound up in Vegas. And actually, the vice president flew out, and I told her I accept the position. And she said, well, you haven't even seen your office. Don't you want to go see Vegas? And I'm like, it's one desert to the other desert. How can it be any different?
Oh, it's different.
Oh, yes, it's different. I have lived from one end of this country to the other because I worked in the hotel industry. And Vegas, there are a few things I can say about it, but it's pretty close to the bottom of the list. And I will say the reason is everything that makes Vegas wonderful to go visit makes it a horrible place to live.
Okay. Well, you can always move back to Phoenix.
No, my husband will have absolutely no part of it.
Aww.
He does not want hot. He does not want cold. He wants ocean, mountains, and good climate, which is really kind of like L.A., but he doesn't want to live in L.A. So We're looking maybe Portland. Who knows where we'll end up? our long-range goal is a tiny house, and so we could end up anywhere in the world. So that's one nice thing. David said he is a film noir and mystery enthusiast, and he is the author of the Detective Heath Barrington murder mystery series, which we're going to find out why he changed that to this new series. But I do want to say that having read this latest book, it isn't noir to me. In fact, it's most certainly not noir. Hmm. How would you define your writing style?
How would I define my writing style? I write murder mysteries, but in a way, the mystery is like a smaller part of the story because I love the, like you said, I love the characters. I love the dialogue. I love getting into the relationship between the characters, you know, and then, oh yeah, along the way they solve a murder. So I have a lot of fun with it. And I hope the readers do too.
Well, I certainly did, without a doubt. And I'm not giving anything away because Philip did a book recommendation of this book about 2 months ago, and he let it slip that the murder does not happen at the beginning of the book as they do in most mysteries. And it's interesting because I have had a discussion with several authors, and probably the very first author that ever pointed out to me was Marshall Thornton. And what Marshall Thornton said is, no matter how well you write a novel, somebody will figure it out. Even if the way they figure it out is wrong, they'll figure it out. So it's okay as long as your characters are interesting, they'll keep going. And you did really the opposite because you didn't give us the mystery, but you gave, at least for me, characters that I care about and found fascinating enough that I wanted to keep learning who they are.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
So let's start talking about them. Well, actually, let's just talk about the story.
Yeah.
I'm going to jump right into it. This is what I call Beyond the Blurb, where, you know, you tell us a little bit on Amazon or the book jacket what the story is about, and that is not acceptable to me. I need to know a little bit more than that, obviously without giving too much of the story away, but take it away.
Yeah, so it's set in 1946 in Phoenix, which I find fascinating. A lot of people, actually people who lived in Phoenix their whole lives, I mean, they're like, there really wasn't anything here in 1946. And I'm like, oh, contraire, there actually was. Doing a lot of research, I found a lot of great old buildings. There actually was a lot of history. It was a fairly decent sized city in 1946, and it had a lot going for it. The hotel, the Westward Ho Hotel, which that name just cracks me up, was built, and that was around. There was quite a few buildings, so there was a lot of history here. And so the story takes place in 46, and Mason Adler is a Phoenix native. He grew up here, and he's a private detective, and he's gay, and he's single. And as the book opens, you find out that he's going to be turning 50, which he has a lot of angst about. And 50 may be the new 40 right now, but back then 50 was like 60, so, or more, 70. People didn't live as long, didn't take as good care of themselves. So it was a big deal turning 50. And of course, it still is to some people today. So that was a big source of contention for him. And he has a little friend named Walter, Walter Wingate. And Walter is only a few months older than Mason, but he likes to goad Mason. He likes to push his buttons, and he's very good at it. And I did get some feedback that people said they found he was really annoying, but I know people like Walter, and I think Walter, underneath it all, is a really good guy. He's just somebody that has had to struggle with his life, and he wants people to notice him. He wants to get attention. He's tired of being ignored his whole life and overlooked. He's also single. He's not overly attractive. He's a little under average in height. So he dresses flamboyantly. He acts flamboyantly. And he definitely pushes Mason's buttons. But underneath it all, they're friends. And they're good friends, even if only by circumstance. So Walter is going to throw Mason a 50th birthday party, and that's where all the action takes place.
And regarding the comment the person made, I had a comment, similar comment to my first novel. I had a character from Mexico who lived in a very crowded Mexican part of Los Angeles. And this guy I know pretty well read it, and he goes, oh my God, you described my family to a T. But I got a review that says, Brad really laid it heavy on the stereotypes, and he really needs to watch himself, you know. And what I always say is, some stereotypes exist for a reason.
Yes, they do.
And as far as Phoenix goes, I was really fascinated by it because you chose 1946, which your previous series that takes place in Milwaukee was also in the 1940s.
Yep.
Later, we're going to get to why you're so fascinated by the 40s. So, but hearing that, because I always wondered, what kind of weirdos lived in Phoenix before there was air conditioning? I mean, what would draw somebody there? So I looked up a little bit of history, and this is probably more than people want to hear. But in 1900, the population was only 5,500 people. In 1929, which is when the very first air conditioner was opened in Phoenix, and that was at a hotel, I think the one that you just named.
The Westward Ho.
The Westward Ho, yes, which would be a pretty good drag name.
You know, they used to have a bar at the top of that hotel called the Top of the Ho.
Oh, that is awesome. Awesome.
I love it.
Well, at that time, the city was 48,000 people, which in that time period was a pretty good sized city. Mm-hmm. Then the 1950s, it got larger and there were 22,000 people. As compared to today, 4.6 million, one of the fastest growing cities in the United States. So it does sound like the jump happened after air conditioning became more popular, but also World War II had a lot to do with it as well.
True.
But now we're talking back about you, since that's really why you're on the show. And this is not the Phoenix History Show, contrary to what you may be hearing. I want to go back to the book, and I want to talk about Mason Adler. And one thing that's interesting is you made him 50 years old. And the reason I say that's interesting is I had two guests recently, Barbara Wilson and Mark McNeese, who both are very big advocates for having older sleuths. Now, theirs are more than in their 50s. But like you said, in 1940, 50s was a pretty old guy. And actually, when Elizabeth Sims and I were a guest on, when she was a guest on the show, we talked about, you know, my mom was the same age as I am today when she died. And before she died, she looked grandmotherly, like the way moms, she was a housewife, she wore a house dress, her hair was up. And nowadays, it's just not that way. But back then, that was a ripe old age.
It was.
Oh. And what I will tell you another thing I like that you did about him. You made him over 6 feet tall, but he only weighs around 160, 165 pounds. So he's gangly.
Yes.
So he's not this 30-year-old, hot, bare-chested, on-the-cover guy. And I want to thank you for that. So now that we have the physicality out of the way, tell us about Mason. What makes him tick?
Yeah, I have a lot of fun with Mason, and in some ways I definitely relate to him because I'm 6'3", so, and I've always been a little gangly myself. So yeah, I like Mason. I wanted to make him older, in part because Heath Barrington, my other detective in the first series, was in his 30s, and he was definitely, you know, a lot hotter, so to speak. So Mason, I wanted to make Mason older. I wanted to make him different than Heath. I didn't want people just saying, oh, Dave Peterson just basically took Heath Barrington to the desert, changed the name, and away they went. So I wanted him to be a totally different character. And there was a whole backstory with him that I've written to, where he had a rather difficult childhood. He is a middle child with an older sister, younger brother, and a very domineering father who wanted him to follow in his footsteps as a carpenter and be really macho and play sports and do all those manly things that some men like to do. And Mason rebelled and struck off on his own. And actually, in the backstory, he moved out of the house when he left school and fell in with some older men that appreciated him and took care of him. And one of them was a private detective. And that's how he ended up getting to become a private detective, through the tutelage of this older man. And now he's an older man himself. And he's a very bright person. He has a really good friend, his neighbor downstairs, Lydia. And she's a delight. I like her as well. She adores Mason, but not in a romantic way, although if things had been different, I think that could have happened with her. So he's just a really interesting character, and I think he's got a lot of backstory that may come out in future books.
If you enjoy Queer Writers of Crime, let others know and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or iTunes. It's easy by clicking Love the Podcast in the show notes. If you prefer another app, you can click the same link to see if they offer them. Who knows? Brad may just read yours on the air.
Well, one thing I like that you also did with him being a PI, he is not one of these down on your on their luck guys. He's well respected. People know him from solving other crimes. Mm-hmm. So he doesn't seem to have a whiskey bottle in the drawer in his desk.
Nope.
I'm guessing that was a conscious decision on your part.
It was. Yeah. I didn't want to make him like your stereotypical gumshoe PI. I wanted to make him a little more tailored. I mean, he's the antithesis of Walter. He wears a lot of gray. He's not real exciting. He doesn't go out and drink, and he doesn't smoke. He's very pretty much clean cut. He's a little dull, as Walter describes him. And Walter's always trying to get him to liven things up. But yeah, I consciously made him well-respected and intelligent and smart, and, you know, show that he's just a regular guy who happens to be gay, which is kind of the way I like to write a lot of my gay characters, that they're just people who happen to be gay. He's not a gay detective. He's a detective who's gay. So,
well said.
Thank you.
So I want to get back to Walter, whose name is Walter Waverly Wingate. And you hear that only James Bond novels, Ian Fleming, can get away with making silly names. But I love Walter Waverly Wingate. I just love it. So you did well.
Thank you.
Their relationship is very funny. They're friends, but I think you already mentioned that Walter is somewhat antagonistic towards Mason. And at times I couldn't decide if Mason was just milquetoast or he just didn't give a damn because he knew that's the way Walter is. What I do like about Walter, because he is flamboyant, he is an interior decorator, he fits so many of those stereotypes, but he's kind of like, let's say the 60s, talk about Paul Lynn and Liberace, and people supposedly did not know they were gay. I don't, you know, whatever. And George Michael is another one. I remember he was being interviewed and he said, I had no idea when I was with Wham that I was gay. And rest in peace, George. The rest of us knew it way before.
Oh, yeah.
So it's funny to me because my feeling is during that era, it would have been a time where it would be pretty clear to people, but you just don't mention it.
Exactly. It wasn't talked about. Everybody looked the other way. They were confirmed bachelors.
Yes. Yes, a confirmed bachelor. And one thing I like about him is you did make him a stereotype in many ways, in the sense that he dresses and his flamboyance and his ability to be very dishy, but you also made him a kind individual who takes in others and helps them out. So there's depth to this character.
Mm-hmm. Yep, there definitely is. Yeah, I didn't want to make him just one-dimensional, so... And he's definitely got a backstory, too. And he, like I think I mentioned, he had a hard life growing up as well. I mean, who hasn't, right? But he's a good guy all the way, all around. So underneath it all.
Well, the other one I want to talk about is Emil. And then I'm going to talk about the whole bunch of them together.
Sure.
But tell us who Emil is.
So he is actually a police detective, and he is a friend, more or less, of Mason, and also a friend, more or less, of Walter, although Walter and Emil don't always see eye to eye, and they're actually more antagonistic than Mason and Walter are. The three of them all went to the same school together, which is kind of how they all met. So they've been friends for many, many years, but Emil is heterosexual, he's straight, and so he's rather unusual in that he knows about Walter and Mason, and yet he's okay with it as long as, again, it's not talked about and as long as they're not in public about it and that they keep it very hush-hush and closeted. But they all get along more or less together. And part of it is just there wasn't a huge gay social network back then. And that's part of the reason Mason puts up with Walter is because, you know, it's a convenience kind of a thing. They've known each other for years and they're both gay and they both know it and it's all good. And Emil is a detective, police detective. So they both have their detective work, even though Mason seems to solve the crimes a little bit before he does often. And, but yeah, there, it's an interesting trio of people and they all kind of work off of one another and also with each other.
Well, it is interesting that Emil is heterosexual and is friends with these two individuals though. And these are my words, not yours, but today somebody would say, don't be so gay.
Right. Yes.
And he has a tendency to say that, like, tone it down, guys.
Yes.
But you kind of hit the nail on the head for me when it comes to Walter and Mason. In my feeling that I got, and it wasn't specifically stated, is these are two guys that under normal circumstances would really just plain hate each other and wouldn't want anything to do with each other. But this is 1946 in a small city where I presume it's like most any other city, you could be arrested and put in the a psych ward for being gay, and so they're together out of necessity.
Correct. They're the support network for each other, for better or worse.
Do you know much about what gay life was like during that era? Did you do any study?
Did a lot of study. I mean, not just Phoenix, but obviously for the whole first series too. I did read all the reports and the studies and how people could get lobotomized, basically. They thought that was a cure for homosexuality. So you would be arrested. You could be, you'd lose your job for sure. You'd lose your social reputation, your standing, and you could even be put into a psychiatric hospital and lobotomized. Terrifying.
Well, and they were right. I guess lobotomy would cure homosexuality.
There you go.
You can't argue that. It isn't the best cure, but it worked. So, but it was there a particular area of town where men met and that sort of thing?
There, I've heard some stories. There were no gay bars. People just didn't exist back then. But there were private house parties that gay men would host, and it was invitation only. So that definitely occurred. People had their codes for meeting up, the parks, the canals, those types of areas, kind of like, it's always been. So gay men will find each other one way or another.
Well, the reason I'm asked is I was curious if it was like Los Angeles. We hear a lot of, I'm going to use the 20s because the term wasn't used, but it was more acceptable during that time period. Again, you just didn't mention it, but drag was very, very more common. And you can find a lot about New York and Chicago and even Philadelphia. And I am researching on gay life in the 1920s in Los Angeles. And from the 20s till about maybe the 50s, there's very little, there's newspaper reports about the raids. I know the parks where the men met. But beyond that, there's very little, there were gay bars, but I can't find any information as to where they are. It was called The Run. No information as to where The Run existed and that sort of thing. And I wondered if you ran into those kind of, because some of it I'm not going to make up. I'm going to take pieces from other decades and kind of put together the best I can. Did you run into those kind of obstacles as well?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely, there wasn't a lot of recorded history about how men cruised each other back in the 40s in Phoenix and where they cruised each other. Just the fact that, as far as I could tell, there were no gay bars per se. I mean, there were obviously bars probably where they tended to congregate more than other ones, but they were not considered gay bars. So
they certainly wouldn't have had a big rainbow Budweiser sign in the window.
No, definitely not.
So I want to talk a little bit more about Lydia. You described, I really hate to use this term, but because I haven't used it, heard it in a while, but it's the best one that can come to mind. In today's language, we would say she's a faggot.
I knew you were going to say that.
I really didn't want to go there, but and I sit there, my brain is spinning, like coming up with something else. And no, I'm sorry. People would have called her a fat cag. Did you at some point consider the possibility of having some type of relationship go on between the two of them?
Like a romantic relationship?
Or a relationship of convenience, more than they did have a relationship of convenience.
Yes, they did.
They took each other to events, which was convenient.
Yep.
Some couples went so far as getting married.
They did. Lavender marriages, yes, absolutely. And I touch on that in the first series quite a bit. I never really considered that with these two, although it is they do kind of talk about it a little bit. That Lydia says she would be willing to do that if it would really help Mason out. But, you know, Mason's like, no, 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 you're my friend. And they met because she lives below him. And as the story goes, he was doing the tango upstairs right after he moved in with a handsome young man. And she went upstairs to find out what all the stomping was about and peeked through the window and saw the two of them dancing together. And she didn't have a heart attack. So... So she knew right from the get-go, and so she's been a very supportive, good friend, and they've been friends for, I think, about 6 years. So she's a good egg. She's single, but she's exploring the dating world also slowly. But I didn't want to make her one of these women that, you know, every girl should be married kind of a thing, even though that was the prevalent attitude back then. I wanted to make her more independent and stronger. And she's self-sufficient. She lives by herself and she has a job and she seems relatively happy that way. She's not always pining after one man or another or Mason. It's not always about, you know, oh, I got to get married. I want to have children. And she's 40. So she's 10 years younger than Mason and she's content with her life.
And actually what's interesting that I found between her and Mason is she wasn't sitting around pining for another man, but Mason was for her.
Yeah.
And she wanted somebody for Mason.
Yes.
And I found that adorable. They're just a fun couple, a very loving friendship couple.
Yes, absolutely. I like Lydia.
So what made you decide after, let's see, you did 7 books in the Heath Barrington mystery series?
Yep.
And that was in Wisconsin, which I believe is where you're originally from,
yep.
Correct?
Most of them were set in Wisconsin, yeah. There were a few that took place elsewhere, but...
What made you decide to make the change?
Well, part of it was I made a big change. I moved to Arizona almost 2 years ago, and I thought about, you know, well, I could just keep writing the Heath Barrington series and see where it goes. I could have him move to Arizona and take, you know, start his life over here. But I'm like, would that be realistic? And I just kind of felt like a change. You know, I felt like Heath Barrington, I don't want to say he's run his course, but, you know, I want to give him a little rest for now. I may go back to him again someday. And I've gotten some questions from readers like, you know, are you going to go back? We want more Heath. And yeah, that may be coming down the pike. But right now, I wanted to strike off in a new direction and just try something totally new because I'm here in a new city and I wanted a new detective in a new city to go with. So I thought, yeah, let's start something new.
I can assure you, if you continue with the current series and maybe add 2 or 3 more, 10 or 20 years down the road, people are still going to be asking, when are you going to bring Heath Barrington back?
I'm sure.
People love their favorites. And I'm that way. I love a series because I like seeing the growth and development of the characters. I enjoy a standalone, but series just really grab me.
I always think it would be interesting to take Heath Barrington like 20 years into the future, into 1966, and Heath would be probably 56. And you know, I can just picture him wearing like bell-bottom pants and the gold chains. Solving those rockin' mysteries of the 60s.
Well, that would be fun.
Yeah, might happen.
What are the differences between Heath Barrington and Mason Adler?
Well, obviously the age. So Mason is about 15 years older. He's also definitely more worldly, more experienced. I always wrote Heath Barrington as being a little more innocent, a little more one man and done kind of a thing. very monogamous, whereas Mason doesn't have much use for that. He's never been a relationship-driven kind of guy. He certainly likes his men, but he doesn't feel the need to be tied down to one in particular or have any kind of a relationship. So those are two of the biggest differences. Obviously, Heath also is a police detective. Mason is a private eye. So that's a little different, too. Heath had to answer to a police chief and abide by a lot of rules. And Mason's a little more free-spirited and can kind of do his own thing. Similarity is they're both very honest. They're both true to their word. And I think they're both generally nice guys.
I would think in Mason's case, that was more common in the 40s, because to have a relationship of some kind would be extremely difficult.
It would.
We know Hollywood stars did it, and I wish I could remember the two biggest ones that you can think of.
Cary Grant and Randall Scott.
Yeah, they had their, yes, they were always referred to as their swinging bachelor pad.
Yes.
Well, there was swinging going on there, but not the kind that the general public was being told about. But people can only get away with that so much.
Yeah.
So my gut feeling is that there probably were a lot of lonely people that wished they had someone to be with the rest of their lives.
Yeah. One thing I found interesting when I was doing some of my research was that a lot of the, when there were couples, when somebody found a couple, you know, they could claim to be roommates, but a lot of them actually pretended to be siblings. So they would move to a different city where nobody knew them. And like, this is my brother or this is my sister, in the case of two women. And they would live as siblings, even though they were actually lovers.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I've never heard that before.
Yeah.
When I was in Las Vegas before I came out, which was, let's say, 20-ish years ago, went to a men's group once a week. And there were a lot of guys in their 80s and some even in their 90s. And they lived married with women until their wives died. I asked several of them, if you had to do it over again, would you do it differently? And they said, that's impossible to answer. Because the world is so different. It's impossible to answer. The answer is, I probably would have done things just the way they were, because that's the way things were.
Sure. That's how it was.
We have to appreciate where we are today.
Absolutely.
So I mentioned earlier you are a film noir and mystery enthusiast. Let's get into film noir. What are some of your favorites?
Oh my gosh. Well, all the Raymond Chandler stuff I love. He was such a descriptive writer. And I mean, I think he set the bar for almost every mystery writer of that period. And then just for slapstick, screwball dialogue and overlapping dialogue and a lot of fun. I loved all the Thin Man movies. They're just a blast to watch. William Powell and Myrna Loy were a total delight. I can never get enough of those. So those are the movies I grew up on. Partly why I chose the 40s for my books, because I loved that era. I loved reading about it. I loved watching all the old films. I used to think life should be more like an MGM musical. I still think life should be more like an MGM musical. I love to sing and dance.
So the TV series in the 70s.
Yes.
That was so groundbreaking. The reason that you reminded me of it is at the opening credits, they describe each of the individuals on the show. And Jessica, they say, the only thing that she would change in the world is she would put it all to music. And I thought, that would be fabulous, wouldn't it? Then you would always know if somebody is happy or pissed off, or you wouldn't have to guess.
Absolutely.
So given that you are a big fan of noir, why do you feel like you didn't go that specific route in your writing?
I guess because...
Yeah, because actually, let me say, this novel almost, to me, it's a cozy.
Yeah.
At least in the end, it becomes a cozy.
You know, I never made a conscious decision to not do noir or to do noir, one or the other. I just kind of write the way I feel. And I start out, as I said before, with the dialogue. And I just kind of let it go where it takes me. So, yeah, to me, this is the kind of book I enjoy reading. And it's the kind of book I like writing. So, I mean, I love reading noirs, but to me, this was more where I wanted to go. And I felt it was a good choice.
In your bio, you actually cover quite a few challenges, to say the least, that we had in your that you had in your life. Let's go back to the very earliest age where you were bullied at school and started skipping school with friends to play hide and seek and Red Rover. And if you were like me, you were the total target at dodgeball. And you say that turned you to reading books and that led you to writing. Given your attitude that I, as I understand you, how do you view that period and as far as the outcome?
You know, the outcome I think was good. It was a really hard period to go through, but I'm like I said, who hasn't had a rough childhood? I mean, I'm sure there are some people out there, but it was a challenging period for me. We changed schools a lot. My dad moved around a lot, and it was especially difficult when I went into fifth grade because I was starting at a brand new school. I was at fourth grade and knew nobody, and I had really thick glasses and was not I was actually very shy. I'm sure you can tell I was always a shy person, but I was very shy. I didn't have any friends. I was terrible at sports. We'd go out for recess and kids would be playing tetherball and all this kind of stuff. And all I really wanted to do was just sit and read somewhere in a corner. So, you know, I hung out by myself a lot and learned to entertain myself. And that's kind of where I started reading and started writing and started journaling and making up stories. And I found when I was writing, you know, life was a lot better. I could be anything I wanted to be. I could be attractive. I could have tons of friends. I could be really popular. So I kind of lived through my characters that I created and created these fantasy worlds. And it just kind of one thing led to another. So yeah, it was a hard period to go through, but you know, I got through it and here we all are.
Well, you certainly handled it in a very healthy manner. I had a similar experience, though when looking back, I'm told by people it wasn't as bad as I remember. But I felt lonely all the time.
Sure.
Because I felt like I just didn't belong.
Yep.
And like you in the fifth grade, I moved, but it was mid-year.
Mm-hmm.
And moving mid-year really sucks.
Yeah.
Really sucks. Because all of a sudden you pop up and you're this weird kid in the back of the room.
Yep. Who's the new kid? So, yeah.
Yeah. Who's the new kid? Exactly. Another major event that happened in your life that upset me to read it is you were a victim of gay bashing.
Yep.
And the reason it upset me is a few years back, many people may remember in West Hollywood, I think it was in the 90s, a couple were outside of a house and eight guys jumped out of a truck, beat them with baseball bats, one with a pipe. And the reason why it touches me, I never met either of the individuals, but the one that had the more serious mental problems being beaten by a pipe, I met his mother and I heard the story. And that will stick with me.
Yeah.
So when I read that you were a victim of gay bashing, it triggered that for me. Are you comfortable talking about what happened?
Yeah, I wasn't for a long time. I used to burst into tears thinking about it sometimes or something would just trigger it. I mean, oh my God. I don't even remember why anymore, but I remember one time we were at a friend's house watching Thoroughly Modern Millie, and I have no idea what triggered it, but I just broke down. I started crying and went and locked myself in the bathroom just thinking about it. So I have no idea what triggered that, but you know, I've kind of moved past it, and something I'll never forget. But I'm thankful that I'm still here. It was a terrible thing to endure. I had a long recovery. They put me in the hospital. I've got a plastic plate up here in my head and a big horseshoe-shaped scar. And while I was recovering, that's again when I picked up my writing because I kind of put it down and forgot about it. So if anything good came out of it, I guess that was one thing. And the fact that I'm still here. It was a very traumatic experience to go through, but it's made me appreciate a lot of things.
Well, I would certainly imagine depression would have been a big part of it.
And fear.
What about rage?
Rage to a degree, a lot of fear. I mean, I swore I would never go back to that bar again. It happened outside a gay bar. country western dance bar. And I was having a great night, and I said goodnight to my friends, and I was walking down the street to my car. It was on a side street, and I actually saw these, I think it was four guys coming. Never even thought about it. They're just, and then the next thing I know, I was on the sidewalk, and then the next thing I know, I was in the hospital.
Have you found since then yourself being more cautious and I can't think of a word for it. Other than not so gay, and I don't want to say that.
Definitely more.
Have you found yourself being more cautious?
Yeah, definitely more cautious, more self-aware when I'm out by myself walking. I mean, it's always in the back of my mind. So I'm always a little more leery, especially after dark. If I am outside by myself or if I am anywhere, if I see anybody, it's always going to be there. My spidey sense starts to tingle and so whatever. So yeah, it's had an impact on me, but I mean, it's a good reminder that everybody should be cautious. I mean, I was always one of these people that was just, pretty happy go lucky, like life's an MGM musical and nothing bad's going to happen. So that was pretty naive on my part, but what you going to do?
And if that wasn't enough, in 2016, you were diagnosed with prostate cancer.
Yep.
And it spread. And I'm guessing from the way you said it to me, it didn't look good.
Yeah.
Would that be accurate?
Yeah.
You had your prostate removed, and you went through 36 radiation treatments?
Yep. Drive myself to the hospital and undergo the treatments.
Ooh.
As I laid on the table with an extremely full bladder. So that was really challenging. And then after the radiation treatments were over, I went through 2 years of hormone therapy where I would get injections in my stomach. So that, but a lot of people go through a lot worse. And so I'm thankful that I'm here, and I'm thankful that things, knock on wood, seem to be under control. And my heart goes out to everybody else who's suffering, because there's a lot of suffering in the world. So just enjoy life as much as we can.
Well, I am going to comment about you saying a lot of people go through a lot worse, because I heard something years ago that I think was very wise. And that is, don't allow other people's suffering to rob you of your own.
That's a good saying. That's true.
But you came out of it, and you said you still feel very lucky.
Yeah.
Lucky you are here.
Absolutely.
What is that? It sounds like, from what I've seen of pictures of you on Facebook, I think we follow each other on Instagram too. Mm-hmm. You just seem like you're living the life. Has it always been that way, or do you feel like that's all a part of these experiences that you had?
I think a little bit of both, probably, Brad. Like I said before, I mean, and it sounds kind of hokey, but I've always been like I belonged in a musical. I've always sang, I've always danced. Almost every job I've ever had, people are like, "Oh, there goes Dave singing and dancing again." I mean, I'd be like walk into the lunchroom and be like, "It's a lovely day today." I'd be like, everybody like, "What?" So yeah, and I've always felt that life is meant to be enjoyed as much as we can. So, that's not to say I don't have bad days, and not every day is a party, believe me. I mean, I was scooping the kitty litter this morning and brushing the cats and doing all those delightful things. But yeah, when there's an opportunity to have a good time or to do something fun or something with friends, friends are the family that we choose, and I love our friends dearly. And so, yeah, I think life is meant to be lived.
We don't post on Facebook or Instagram the pictures of us cleaning the toilet.
No. So,
we know there is real life is behind those pictures, but
exactly.
Some people just have just more exciting and thrilling pictures to see than others. And I think you are one of those. You are a caring individual, in the sense that you've told me you rescue earthworms off the sidewalk, you catch and release spiders in the house.
I do.
And I actually got to admit, I do the same thing.
Oh, good.
I try to leave the spiders. My mom always taught me spiders are good. They get rid of the bugs. Well, sometimes I don't always like them there, but I won't crush them. And you said you've always tried to be kind to all living creatures. So it's no surprise that you are a vegetarian. People become vegetarians for different reasons. What was the reason that you said, I'm going to be a vegetarian?
It was definitely because of concern for the animals. I visited a lot of animal rescue sites and farm rescue sites, and it's not a pleasant experience. I mean, I'm glad those animals are okay, but then I think about all the animals that are not. And so, it was a conscious decision on my part that I didn't want to do that. So, and I don't mind it. It's been totally fine. My husband is not a vegetarian. He's gotten a lot more so, but he will still eat meat occasionally.
I was a vegetarian for a number of years, and I think for a lot of people, a lot of reasons, I just felt that it's a much healthier lifestyle. I did a lot of study and said, this is more healthy to eat. And then, like almost everybody I know that gets into it for health reasons, the animal rights part becomes a big part of it and keeps them there for a while. And I was actually vegan for 2 years. And I will say the hardest part is going out.
Mm. Yeah. Although it's gotten a lot better. It's gotten a lot better.
Yes, it has. Yes. We have a place here. Well, actually, I'm not in LA anymore. But when I lived in LA, that made the most incredible vegan meatloaf you ever had.
Wow.
If you're ever in Hermosa Beach, go to The Spot.
The Spot.
And get their meatloaf. Okay. The Spot. Get their meatloaf.
Good to know.
So you're also involved in other environmental actions. What are some of those?
Well, definitely, I believe in solar. I mean, I believe in solar power. I believe in water conservation, which is huge around here. When I was a strange child, I had two buddies, two friends. I didn't have a lot of friends, but I had these two guys, and I thought we should start a club. So we started a club called the Owls, and our goal was to walk around and pick up litter and clean up, which is probably a real strange thing for like a 10 or 11 year old kid to be doing, but that's what we did. So yeah, I've always kind of had that in the back of my mind that, we got one planet and one life and we got to protect it. So,
and I don't think that's so strange at 10 years old.
Good.
At all. I don't think that's the least bit strange.
Oh, good. Some people did.
Well, as we're winding down, we now have what we call awkward questions authors get.
Mm.
And what I did, I pulled a large number of authors and said, give me some questions that you've gotten that are weird, hard to answer, just plain rude.
Got it.
And I have a collection of them, and we spin the wheel, and we see which one you get.
Can we spin the bottle instead?
You're too far away for me to kiss you. I guess I could kiss the screen, but, that's just not the same.
There you go.
I learned that years ago.
Yeah. I hear you.
So hold on, and we're going to spin the wheel. Okay, are you ready for your question?
I'm as ready as I'll ever be.
How come none of your books are in Philadelphia?
Somebody asked that. I don't even know how to respond to that. Maybe I should have Mason go visit Philadelphia. That's a very awkward question. No clue. Because I lived in Milwaukee, so they were set there, and now I live in Phoenix, so they're set here. If I ever move to Philadelphia, I'll write a book there.
There you go. Make a promise. Move to Philadelphia. You will get your Philadelphia story.
Oh, that's a good movie. I love the Philadelphia story.
That was a good movie. In fact, it's been ages. I need to watch that again.
Cary Grant, Jimmy Stewart.
To wrap this up, my guest is David S. Peterson, and his most recent novel that is available now. Remember that as soon as this show is over, you can go and buy it now. He would have no complaints if he did so. It is Murder on Monte Vista, and is available pretty much everywhere.
Yes, sir.
All right. So you have no excuse. Go get it. And the last thing I want to say, David wrote a really great blog post that's on the guest blog. The link is right there in the show notes. And go take a look. You'll like it. So thank you, David.
Thank you, Brad. A pleasure. It was a lot of fun.